This week on Making Contact.
We're really building on a level of organizing, a level of mobilization that puts us in a position to begin transforming what it is that we've previously thought of as a liberation movement in this country.
We Are the 99% has become a rallying cry for people occupying their cities and towns across the United States. People uniting to change a system based on greed and exploitation. Many are now asking how to move towards a common vision that addresses the needs of everyone within the 99%.
What if the 99% in the U.S. called for no war, build the economy for people and the planet? What if we did that?
On this edition, we'll take a look at what it'll take to transform this movement moment to long-term solidarity for systemic change. I'm Megan LaSala, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
It's waking up so many people. I mean, look at this crowd. Ages, colors, races, genders. You know, people are waking up together. So I'm hopeful that we're going to make a change. I know we are making it already.
You know, until about a week or two ago, I also supported the Occupy movement, but it's just grown to be a bit unruly, and at this point, I don't completely understand what it's standing for.
The first step to, like, change is just an awakening of awareness to the connections between problems and, like, what the real problems are.
I think it's in the beginning stages, just like the civil rights was, and it's okay that we might not know the direction, because I'm sure Martin Luther King, and neither did Malcolm X or anybody else know within the first 2 months of the great civil rights movement where they were going.
We'll hear a roundtable discussion about the future of the Occupy movement. But first, we bring you excerpts of an address given by former Secretary of Labor and Professor of Public Policy, Robert Reich. On November 16th, the day of the UC Berkeley's general strike, he spoke to a crowd of thousands on campus, just after an Occupy Cal encampment was forcibly removed by police.
Now, the First Amendment, right to speech, that is not always convenient. It is not always inexpensive. It is sometimes messy. And because it's sometimes inconvenient and sometimes expensive and sometimes messy, just like democracy, there is a temptation sometimes to want to contain it, to limit it. But it is more important than it has ever been that we all go out of our way, every one of us, leaders, politicians, those of us who have authority, and those of us who do not have authority, it becomes doubly important that we honor the First Amendment and that we are willing and make ourselves willing to pay the price of freedom of speech and also indirectly, or because freedom of speech is so related to democracy, directly the price of a democratic system of government. Some of you are concerned also about the increasing concentration of wealth and income in our society, an increasing concentration that has meant, for example, that the top 400, the 400 richest Americans, now own more of America than the bottom 150 million Americans. Let me try to connect some of these dots. Fundamentally, the problem with concentrated income and wealth, and fundamentally, the problem with an educational system that is no longer available to so many young people, and even a K-12 system that is letting so many people down. The fundamental problem is that we are losing equal opportunity in America. We are losing the moral foundation stone on which this country and our democracy are built. Now, there are some people out there who say we cannot afford education any longer. We cannot afford, as a nation, to provide social services to the poor. We cannot, some people say, any longer afford, as a nation, to provide the safety nets for the poor and the infirm, or for people who fall down for no fault of their own. Well, how can that be true if we are now richer than we have ever been before? How can that be true, that we cannot afford to do all sorts of things that we need to do for our people when we are the richest nation and continue to be the richest nation in the world? And again, let me connect the dots, because over the last 3 decades, this economy has doubled in size, but most Americans have not seen much gain. If you adjust for inflation, what you see is the median wage has barely risen. Where did all the money and resources go? They went to the top. And look it, let's be clear about this. We are not vilifying people because they're rich. The problem here is that when so much income and wealth go to the top, political power also goes to the top. The problem has to do with what that does to our democracy. It undermines our democracy. When all that money can come down from the wealthy, from the corporations, when there are no limits to the amount of money that can infect and undermine and corrupt our democracy, then what do we have left? What do we have left? The Occupy movement, the Occupy Cal, the Occupy Oakland, occupations are going on all over this country, are ways in which people are beginning to respond to the crisis of our democracy. Ways in which, and I am so proud of you here today. Your dedication to these principles, your willingness to be patient, your willingness to spend hours in general assemblies, your willingness to put up with what you have already put up with is already making a huge difference. You are already succeeding. Some of you may feel a little bit, what are we doing here? What exactly is our goal? I urge you to be patient with yourselves. Because with regard to every major social movement of the last half century or more, it started with a sense of moral outrage. Things were wrong. And the actual coalescence of that moral outrage into specific demands for specific changes came later. The moral outrage was the beginning. The sense of things going wrong was what was most important. The days of apathy are over, folks. Once this has begun, it cannot be stopped and will not be stopped.
That was the voice of Robert Reich speaking on the day of UC Berkeley's general strike at an event to memorialize Mario Savio, a free speech movement organizer and UC Berkeley student of the 1960s. Up next, a roundtable with 3 guests from the San Francisco Bay Area, discussing how the movement of the 99% can move forward towards long-term solidarity. Nita B. is one of the original participants at Occupy Oakland and is a member of the People of Color Committee. Maria Poble is the executive director of Causa Justa, Just Cause, a housing rights organization that's working with the Occupy movement to fight foreclosures. And Steve Williams is the co-founder and co-director of Power, also known as People Organized to Win Employment Rights. Making Contact production intern Christopher Holmbeck moderated the discussion.
I'd like to begin by asking you, Maria, what went through your head the first time you heard about Occupy Wall Street?
Well, my very first thought was, yes, yes, finally, the people of the United States have taken issue with the corporations of the United States that have done so much harm to our communities inside the United States and then also in other countries. I remember thinking maybe not everybody is asleep. Maybe people have noticed what's been happening over the last 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. Maybe now the United States people's movements will actually show their face and show their allegiances, and their allegiances will not be with their corporations, but instead with regular everyday people. And it just seemed like such a timely critique. And the fact that it was out in the streets where nobody could deny it and where it was in control of everyday people, it was inspiring.
Did you have the same immediate sense of joy, Steve?
Well, no, I think I was probably a little less optimistic and hopeful. I remember actually seeing the call that went out in Adbusters. And I was like, really? These are going to be the people who occupy Wall Street? As somebody who has spent more than a decade organizing in working class African-American and Latino communities, I know that our communities have been deeply impacted by financial institutions and by the system of capitalism. And I didn't think that it was going to be the readers of Adbusters that were going to take the first step to begin confronting financial institutions in this country.
What about you, Nita?
I had been watching, keeping tabs on what was going on Wall Street, and really was pleasantly surprised that white middle class America was standing up. And I kept my eye on it because I thought it was very powerful to be putting Wall Street on front and having the slogan of the 99 versus the 1. I think that was really powerful to me. And then I was really surprised to watch it spread like wildfire across the U.S. That got me really interested in, like, wow, what's going on? That whole slogan, 99 against 1, is what got me. And really seeing this as an opportunity that people were linking not just on a national level but an international level. And that what I understand with history is that many times it took the bourgeois class or the white class, whatever that buffer class was in a society, to be impacted by a financial and political crisis for them to actually take the streets. And when they did that, that was like the impetus for, like, across an entire nation to start a serious social change. And so that's what I saw happening here, and which is why I got involved. If it was just an Oakland thing, I probably wouldn't have gotten involved.
You've been all calling this movement middle class or middle class and white. So it seems like a good time to play a clip from you from a protest in the Bay Area, Poor People's Decolonization March. And Lisa Gray Garcia, one of the organizers, had some things to say about the Occupy movement.
We're poor people. We're occupied with things like budget cuts and whether we're going to feed our children tomorrow. I think that a lot of the Occupy movements are more focused on middle class folks. And that's not a critique. That's a beautiful thing. That isn't where we're coming from. I don't actually feel part of the 99%. I think that the 99% is part of the peoples that oppress us. A lot of the movements actually are filled with a lot of racist and classist stereotypes, and unfortunately don't even know how to relate to folks in poverty. And there's been a lot of racial tension. There is a lot of folks who, with race and class privilege, who take part in the Occupy movements. Again, this is not to splinter or take down their movements, but to help them understand that they need to get race consciousness. They need to get consciousness about poverty. They need to recognize the connections.
What's your reaction to what Lisa Gray Garcia says here?
I think a lot of us people of color who've interacted with the Occupy camps can certainly identify with that feeling of the camps not having enough clarity about race and racism and what it does to communities and gender inequality and poverty and issues of class. I think that critique is right on. And I think the challenge before us is, can we lead from a place of unity? What is the unity that you could accomplish? A lot of people want to do something, but the idea that we should work together, choose a target, choose demands, is not an automatic thing. And so those of us who've been doing community organizing have that and can contribute that to the movement if the dynamics are such that there's space for that. So then there's all these sort of political cultures intersecting. There's the way that unions do their work, think about their work, communicate their work, the way that community organizations like mine do it, and then this camp that has its own culture that also draws on some anti-hierarchical traditions, anti-authoritarian commitments, and then there's everything else.
It is also important to acknowledge that in different encampments across the country, those political cultures are coming together and sort of innovating new models. In New York and then also in San Francisco, one of the things that the General Assemblies have established are these action committees where existing community organizations, trade unions, other affinity groups are enabled to select a representative to come to a weekly meeting to then talk about how it is that those existing memberships can engage with the General Assembly process and more broadly with the We Are the 99% movement. And so I think that it is important to acknowledge that each of the particular encampments are just struggling to innovate new models that both ensure direct democracy but also connect with existing organizing efforts in the communities.
Some people have a critique of community organizing or nonprofits or other forms of organization, and that's where they're coming from. And I think that's a useful political dialogue to engage in. It's not all about doing it the way that we've been doing it so far, because if everything we'd been doing so far was perfect, we would have had this movement a long time ago, right? Community organizations and unions and the sort of more institutionalized progressive movement hasn't been as nimble or militant or creative or committed to movement building as we've needed to be. And we're one of the organizations committed to changing that. And that means taking risks and trying things that you haven't done before.
So Nida, do you think that the model that Steve told about that is in New York and other places could work in Oakland?
I think that kind of model can definitely work in Oakland. And that move is being made. Organizations that have been in the trenches and doing the work for decades are coming together and linking it to just this concept of the 99%. My thing is, like, if you're going to be talking about 99%, let's really break that down. Let's make a pie chart and figure out what that really means. who's the 99%? And, you know, how this political and economic fiasco affects the different sectors of the 99% is very different. And I think that's related to the class and a race analysis. That, you know, when we start looking at each other's experiences here, that broadens the potential of what we can be fighting for so that everyone walks away from this winning.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 1-800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how you can support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. You can also follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook. We now return to our roundtable on building a long-term movement of the 99% with Maria Poblet, Executive Director of Causa Justa, Just Cause, Steve Williams, Co-Director of Power, People Organized to Win Employment Rights, and Nita B., an Occupy Oakland participant, moderated by Making Contact production intern Christopher Holmbeck. We'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you,
till you do. Steve Williams, you have a long experience with organizing poor people and people of color. What's your reactions to these problems?
Well, I think the challenges that Anita and Maria are pointing to are exactly right. I mean, they're at play in encampments all across the country. But it's also a predictable challenge that the movement has to face. In a country with the history of white supremacy, colonialism, genocide, slavery, we know that we're going to encounter some particular challenges around racial consciousness, around the leadership of women, around the role of young people. But what the We Are the 99% movement has created is an opportunity for us to actually be able to engage in those struggles from a progressive standpoint. And the movement is still very new, so the language is all coming together. But in my mind, this movement is a movement of the 99%. The occupations are a particular tactic of that movement. So there are a lot of people who are participating in the movement to confront financial institutions and the system of capitalism that aren't sleeping out at the various parks across the country. And it's critical for us to figure out ways for people to be able to engage constructively, because our organizations that are rooted in working class communities of color, have been doing the organizing around a particular strata of the 99%. It is important to acknowledge that the petty bourgeois and technocratic professionals who are now disaffected by the way that capitalism is operating, it's important to acknowledge that those people should be mad. But we also have to then figure out the programs and solutions and demands that we are all going to fight for that doesn't throw sections of the 99% under the bus.
Maria.
On the national scale, now white working class communities who have been impacted by these measures of austerity and by this corporate takeover, they have a choice between the Tea Party and Occupy. And I want all of them to choose Occupy. It's very needed in this country for people to have a choice that takes them to the left in the face of corporate domination, instead of basically everybody joining the Tea Party and moving to the right and blaming immigrants, blaming people of color. And while these racial dynamics
get handled in the camps, that's where and how we will see if the movement will be able to proceed in a way that actually builds the capacity of the movement to build more unity and to move towards a progressive outcome, actually, an outcome that benefits all communities.
Since we're leading up to the next presidential campaign, how should the Occupy movement engage with electoral politics? Steve?
Well, I think the critical thing is that the We Are the 99% movement has to develop a vision of what our alternative is. The exciting innovation with the camps is that different groupings of people who have been disaffected and disenfranchised by this economic system have had a space to come together. So folks who've had their homes foreclosed upon, folks who are in debt and can't find a job after graduating from elite universities are coming together with homeless people and are coming together with other folks who have just generally seen public services cut and attacked over the last few years. And I think what's happening with that is that people are beginning to develop more and more of a systematic analysis of what is wrong. But ultimately, that means that we have to do more, way more, than elect a sympathetic person into elected office.
In the sort of more institutional progressive sector, there's the idea you elect somebody who's a Democrat and then you look the other way and cross your fingers. And that has never worked for us. It's right. Never worked for people of color to do that. In fact, mm-hmm. at any time where people of color have won great demands in this country, it's by actually challenging the Democratic Party to represent its interests by all kinds of different tactics, including threatening to start another party, starting another party. And it always has to go back to this platform, this list of what we want, this vision of where we're headed. And then we say to any elected official, get in or get out, right? Mm-hmm. This is where we're headed. Come with us or don't.
Nita, from being inside Occupy Oakland and working with the people there, do you think that the time is right now for the Occupy movement to move forward and build a political platform together and start making a list of demands?
I think, one, it's essential if this is going to move forward. Our focus can transition into something, into broadening the movement in its demographics and of actually developing a platform and developing some demands. And there are some demands, but they're very broad and they're not really asking for things. It's very much we are against this, but it's not saying what we want. If we're against this, what do we want?
And the only way that any movement is able to defend its principled demands is to have clarity about what direction it's moving in. So one of the things that we clearly saw, for example, in the South African anti-apartheid movement was that time and time again, the apartheid regime tried to figure out measures to be able to give concessions to some section of the community and at the same time sell out the larger majority of the population. It was only through the Freedom Charter and the clarity of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa to a vision of what a truly democratic society would look like that they were able to hold on to that vision, fight for it through all the twists and turns, and then ultimately able to establish at least politically, a democratic system in that country. Now, I think that the challenge for us in the United States is that for too long we've been told that capitalism is the only way to operate an economy. And I think that it's one of the things that is important right now is for us to take lessons from the mass mobilizations that have been taking place around the globe, from Cairo to Barcelona to Athens to the successful movement in Latin America and Cochabamba and other places. And so I think in being able to sort of build on the lessons, insights of those movements, we here in the United States can begin developing a notion of a transformative vision and a new liberatory economy.
How can we use this movement and moment to build long-term solidarity and political education? Maria?
In addition to demands, which we've talked about a fair amount here, I think we need to get clear on the role of the U.S. in the international arena. Our government is the 1% to the rest of the world. I've had the opportunity to be part of the World Social Forum process and the U.S. Social Forum process, and there's strengths and weaknesses to that that can be compared to Occupy movement and existing organizations and that relationship, because it's a space of convergence. And actually, convergence is the first step to joint action, which is what we need, actually, because then we can actually move towards something that would be much bigger. Like, what if the 99% in the U.S. called for no war,
no warming, build the economy for people on the planet. What if we did that? What would that look like? What would the details of that be like? That would then say, instead of there is no alternative, there is one, and we're building it right here, right now, because another world is possible, but also it's absolutely necessary. In order for another world to be possible, another U.S. has to come into being. And this Occupy movement and the convergence between that and previous generations and community organizing and other sectors of progressives, that convergence is actually going to make that other world possible.
Here on a local level, what we should be thinking about is doing some kind of educational campaign, both for our own communities that don't connect the dots between our lives here and Wall Street. I think there's a disconnect. Wall Street is something over there that rich people play with. It's not something that actually trickles down. They talk about this trickle-down economy, and it definitely trickles down, not the money, but the problems. And I think that we, on one level, an educational campaign, which is also like linked with outreach into our own communities and helping connect those dots. And I think within the existing Occupy Oakland movement, an educational campaign around race and class and immigrant status, so that we're starting to kind of break these ideas that people have, that we're not all this monolithic 99%.
I mean, I think one thing that we've absolutely got to concentrate on is defending the encampments. Folks have created a space for various sections of society to come together to engage in a level of conversation, dialogue, and conspiring that hasn't been possible because of the disenfranchisement and alienation that our society has promoted. And so I think defending either the encampments or other spaces that allow all of these folks to come together is absolutely critical. I think it's important for us to understand that these movement moments happen at a time where things feel very fast, but things are actually happening at sort of different time periods. So in some ways, like talking about New York as only having 6 weeks more than Occupy San Francisco or Occupy Oakland just shatters my mind. I mean, it feels like they've been at it for 2 or 3 years. The lessons that we've been able to learn over the series of just a couple months are equivalent to what it is that we've learned over 2 or 3 decades previously. I think it's critical for us to understand that at this particular moment, because of the changing demographics, the changing economic system, the changing politics in the United States, that this movement didn't come out of nowhere. That we're really building on a level of organizing, a level of mobilization that really puts us in a position to actually be able to begin transforming what it is that we've previously thought of as a liberation movement in this country.
Ye come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. You have been listening to a roundtable discussion on building a long-term movement of the 99%, with Maria Poblet, Steve Williams, and Nita B., moderated by Making Contact production intern Christopher Holmbeck. Special thanks to John Hamilton and Julia Lundberg for portions of the audio. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Andrew Stelzer and Kyungjin Lee producers, Irene Flores, web editor, Steph St. Clair, development associate, and Barbara Barnett, Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, Alton Bird, Catherine Lee, and Dashiell Moore volunteers. I'm Megan LaSala. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
The bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. But laws of this republic they rewrite.